Welcome to the Conservative Thought Hour, where America always comes first.
I'm proud to be an American.
Each week, we bring you captivating guests who will speak on many topics of national interest. We are not interested in telling you what to think or how to think. We have faith that you can do that for yourself. Our interest is to bring you information to help you form your own opinions. As always, the views expressed by our guests are their own and are not necessarily shared by the host or the station you are listening to. Get ready for enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
And now, here are your hosts, Carrie Black and Rick Stannard.
Well, a good Saturday morning to you, and welcome to another hour of the Conservative Thought Hour. If you've listened before, welcome back. If you're a brand new listener, a big welcome to you. We're here every Saturday morning from 9 a.m. until 10. Carrie Black along with you for another hour, and Rick Stannard, the political activist. He is my co-host. Good morning, Rick. We have a very special guest that I know you're excited about this hour.
We certainly do, and good morning to you, Carrie. We have Roger Garside. Roger Garside is coming to us from London, England. He is a man of extreme accomplishments, and I'm going to read a bio for our listeners so they know who they will be listening to. Roger Garside brings to the writing of his new book, China Coup, a unique combination of experience as diplomat, development banker, and capital markets advisor, who has lived and worked for decades on the front line of change in China and other countries in transition from the command economy to a free market. This has enabled him to revel in depth the deep-seated moral, environmental, social, intellectual, and cultural problems that are interacting with the economics to determine the communist regime in China. From 1968 to 1970, Garside was posted to the British diplomatic mission in Beijing, where he observed the Cultural Revolution firsthand. From 1971 until 75, Roger took a break from the diplomatic service, studying at MIT before working for the World Bank as country program officer in Thailand. Roger returned to Beijing for a second tour from January 76 to January 79, where he reported on the struggle for power following the deaths of first Chou Enlai and then Mao Zedong, which led to the victory of Deng Xiaoping and the subsequent opening and economic reform in China. He then took a year's leave to teach Chinese politics at the U.S. Navy Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. During this time, Garside also wrote the highly acclaimed Coming Alive, China, After Mao. He holds degrees in English literature from Cambridge University and in management science from MIT. He speaks, reads, and writes Mandarin Chinese. Boy, what a resume that is, Roger.
You're too kind.
I have a question for you. Not many of our listeners know anything about China's social credit system. Can you please provide an explanation of what it is and to what ends it was created?
I'll do my best. The social credit system in China assesses people on the basis of number of aspects of their lives, but it includes their conformity to the political doctrines and norms of the Communist Party of China. So it assesses their political behavior as well as their commercial or social behavior. And if they don't, if they get a low score on the social credit system, which is maintained by the government authorities, controlled by the Communist Party, then they can find themselves denied access to airline travel. They can find themselves denied access to higher education, and it is a tool of control.
So they have to be good little communists to get anywhere in China.
That's right.
Wow. Sounds like a lot of fun. And is that a fully implemented policy in China, or is that fairly new?
It's, as I understand it, it is being rolled out on regional pilot schemes at the moment, with the intention of rolling it out nationwide very soon. But I think it has not yet got 100% coverage of the nation. I think they are trying out different variations of this scheme in different regions of China. And then they'll assess the results of the pilot schemes in the different regions and meld that into a national model.
Well, I can imagine that other countries who are becoming more authoritarian or totalitarian might be wanting to install something like this. This is
a frightening
thought.
But I'm sure you're right, and I'm sure that the communist regime of China, would be only too delighted to share their system with others, to export their system of control.
Wow. Well, here's another topic that I find very interesting. China has created, like many other countries, and is working to perfect a digital currency. Nothing China does is without an eye towards international consequences. I don't suppose that China's digital currency is entirely altruistic. Can you tell us what their game is and how it will affect both the global community and the average American?
Well, I have to modify your expectations somewhat. It is being developed first domestically in China. I don't see it being adopted or affecting the life of your average American or Brit in the near future. It is a system which will serve various purposes, some of them perfectly legitimate. I mean, first of all, it's important to say that this digital currency will be entirely under the control of the Central Bank of China. It is not being privately developed and run. So it is very much a centralized or official system. And on the positive side, it should make it very much easier for the authorities to spot criminal abuse of the financial system. But by the same token, it can be used. It can be used to discriminate against people whom the authorities disapprove of, perhaps because they don't toe the communist line. It's another system of control. It's potentially another system of control strengthening this totalitarian regime's grip on the country, together with the social credit system, which we talked about just now. Now, well, I don't see liberal democracies doing anything to allow the Communist Party of China to export this system to control citizens of other of liberal democracies.
Well, it's interesting. In your own book, you mention the fact that China is at a disadvantage when the world's currency reserve is U.S. dollar. And this might be an attempt to remove the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve.
Well, other nations other than China, are free to hold their reserves in whatever currencies are available to them. It's, as I think you know, Rick, because you're a very well-informed man, the Chinese currency, the renminbi, or yuan, as it's sometimes referred to, is not at present freely convertible. And it's most unlikely that it will become freely convertible in the near future. We'll go into the reasons for that later. But it isn't freely convertible, and therefore other nations don't want to hold their reserves in renminbi, in the Chinese currency. They got the IMF's approval for their currency being classified as a reserve currency, but there's been a very, very low take-up on it for the very reasons I have explained. Now, if they don't permit the renminbi as it in its non-digital form to be freely convertible, I don't see any prospect that they're going to allow the digital form of that currency to be freely convertible. Why? Yeah. I mean, would you like us to go into the reasons why for that, or would you want to hold that for later?
No, we can go into that. I think it's important to know.
Well, this regime, this communist regime in China, depends for its continued existence and its continuation in power, not on the trust of the people, but on control. And there is not a high degree of trust between the people and those who rule them. And there is not great confidence on the part of those who hold wealth in China in the party and government of China. That's why the Chinese Communist Party does not permit people to freely export and import capital and to freely trade their currency. People find all kinds of ways of getting money out, which are semi-legal or illegal. But for the main part, the Communist Party does not permit that. And it's not only a matter of distrusting their own people and being distrusted by them, but it's also a matter of sovereignty, of not wanting other countries to be able to influence their economic conditions and decision making. in the way that can happen if your currency is freely convertible. So those
absolutely
are very powerful reasons, which no totalitarian regime is going to dispense with very in the short term.
Well, I do know that the United States itself is working on a digital currency to replace printed dollars and minted coins. So it's certainly something that is coming in the world and something we need to be prepared for. The frightening thing is that digital currencies are smart. They know what they're being spent on. So every dollar someone spends using a digital currency, everybody knows what was bought, when, and for how much. It's just frightening what can happen with digitals.
Well, I think there's a lot. It's early stage of development of these currencies, and China is somewhat ahead of other countries in the development of it, I think because of the objectives which I have spelled out. But I think that any system which is put in place in the United States or other free market countries will be transparent. It will be subject to the rule of law, and our political systems will ensure that it is not abused by the authorities for controlling our lives.
Well, I love your optimism, Roger. I don't fully share it in the U.S. because we're watching our institutions attack the citizens, the FBI, the Justice Department, all sorts of institutions are leading the attack on people in this country. So I don't have much confidence that the digital currency here will be free and safe and a happy story.
Well, I'm not going to get further into discussing American domestic politics.
All right. Well, Kerry, how are we doing on time?
We are doing fine. You up to 17 minutes. You have about six left.
All right. Roger, you are a former British diplomat who twice served in the British Embassy in Beijing. You then wrote the highly acclaimed book, Coming Alive, China After Mao, which tells us how and why Deng Xiaoping won the struggle for succession to the Chairman Mao, and what he would do with his power. What was the difference between Mao and Deng?
Right. Well, Mao was a romantic revolutionary. He had these huge vaulting ideas about the transformation of Chinese society. If we go back to the late 1950s, he had this campaign for a great leap forward, which was going to leap from socialism to complete communism, completely abolishing private property. And it led to chaos, disease, starvation, and 46 million premature deaths. When it was turned into such a disaster, his colleagues at the top of the Communist Party forced him to stand back from everyday government. And Deng Xiaoping was one of those who played a leading role in bringing Mao out of the front line and putting him on the shelf, if you like, putting him on a pedestal. Mao fought back with the Cultural Revolution and overthrew Deng Xiaoping and Liu Shaoqi and the other pragmatic, more pragmatic members of the Communist Party leadership. When Mao died, Deng Xiaoping was still alive and still very vigorous, and he won the struggle for the succession to Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong, and he brought his pragmatism to bear on economic and social policies. He recognized that collective ownership in China had failed, as it was failing in the Soviet Union, and that private enterprise was flourishing in Chinese communities outside China, flourishing in Hong Kong, where I had lived, flourishing in Taiwan, which I'd visited, flourishing in Singapore. And you can see that private ownership in free enterprise in the Republic of Korea, South Korea, Japan were brilliantly successful. And so, gradually, over the next 15 years, he led the communist regime into a degree of liberalization of the economy and of social life, stepping back from the extreme totalitarian control which Mao had tried to exercise, stepping back from the total persecution and attempted elimination of all religion in China. But Deng Xiaoping never engaged in political liberalization any more than Mao had done. But there you have, and the other thing is that Deng Xiaoping opened up China to the outside world. Under Mao, China had been isolated, autarkic, closed off to the world, even at loggerheads with the Soviet Union in his latter years. And Deng opened up China. He had two words to describe his strategy for China: reform and opening. The reform referred above all to the economy, and the opening to the relations with the outside world. But he recognized that along with the import of goods and capital would come ideas from the free nations of the world, and that that could cause trouble for the Communist Party. And it certainly has.
Roger, your new book, China Coup, I've read it, and I have to tell you, it is an absolutely compelling read, partly because you've blended semi-fiction with details and real life. And it's interesting to see, to read the book, to see how rivals of the current leader, Xi Jinping, could remove him from office in a coup d'etat and then launch a Chinese transition to democracy. Let me ask you, how likely is it that Xi will be replaced anytime soon, and China will move from communism to democracy?
Well, I believe it is entirely possible. I'm not going to put a number, a probability figure on it happening in the next 18 months. But as I spell out in the factual, non-fiction part of the book, the three quarters of the book which I devote to factual analysis. This supposedly successful regime is in fact plagued with a whole array of long-term, deep-seated problems. And the trajectory on which Xi Jinping is leading China and has led China since he came to supreme power in the country in 2012 is viewed with alarm by a very large proportion of the senior officials of his Communist Party. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. Since I finished writing this book, a professor, Chinese professor, who spent 15 years training the senior officials of the Communist Party of China in ideology and politics, has left China and resettled in the United States and has very recently published a 28-page essay on the Hoover Institution's website. And she says that from her deep knowledge of senior officials of the Communist Party of China, 60 to 70% of them regard constitutional government and free society, such as we see in the United States and other democracies, they regard that as the best model for China as well as other countries. So there is a great deal of disaffection and alarm in China regarding Xi Jinping's leadership and where he is leading the country. Now, there isn't going to be a popular uprising in China, as far as I can see, anytime soon. But I do believe it's possible that under the right conditions, and we'll come to that, under the right conditions, rivals of Xi Jinping who disapprove of his leadership would be prepared to move against him and remove him from office in a coup d'etat, as I described, and then launch a transformation of their political system. Now, if you look around the world today, there aren't any large number of alternative political systems which they could choose from. The tried and tested system of competitive democracy with the rule of law, with the freedom of expression, with an independent judiciary. This system would permit them to tackle the deep-seated long-term problems of which I have spoken. So there's no point in them trying to invent a new system. It was Winston Churchill who said that democracy is the worst system of government in the world, except for all the others that have been tried. And those words of Churchill are still true today. And my experience going around the world, working in many different countries, has led me to believe more and more strongly that Churchill got it right.
Well, Churchill is certainly one of the men I look up to, an amazing human being, the right man for the right time in this world.
Yes.
So, your book is one quarter semi-fiction and three quarters nonfiction. Why did you choose this unusual format? And I have to tell you that it makes an incredibly compelling read.
Well, I'm delighted you found it to be so. I chose it because I thought the semi-fiction device would challenge people to take a fresh look at China, to set aside for a while their preconceived ideas about China. It would awaken their imagination. I take them inside the minds of the Chinese leadership in a way that no other book has attempted to do, neither fiction nor nonfiction. And get people to set aside their preconceived notions and ask themselves, what if there was a coup d'etat against Xi Jinping? Why shouldn't there be? That's why I did it. And I must say that I'm getting very good feedback from many different quarters. Lots of people find it, tell me that it is a terrific read.
Yep, it is. And where can people get the book?
Well, I'm not allowed to advertise, but they can go online, and you know, the big online retailers. There's one that begins with A that immediately springs to mind.
I bought my copy on Amazon, so you can go ahead and say it.
Okay. I mean, Amazon is, I think it's responsible for 80% of book sales in the U.S., and they certainly are stocking it. And I'm very glad to tell you, Rick, that just yesterday and today, The Economist weekly news magazine has brought out a review which covers my book and four other books which assess the Communist Party of China. And it gives you a very favorable review of my book.
Well, I can certainly believe that. And one of the nice things is it's also available on Kindle format. So you can put it on your phone or your tablet and take it with you without having to carry paper.
Wherever you are in the world. And you can
get
it immediately.
That's right. That's right. Okay, Roger, in your book you described today's regime in China as a totalitarian regime in an advanced stage of political decay. This will shock and surprise most Americans who see it, who see China as an authoritarian regime that is highly successful and leading China to overtake America as the world's most powerful nation. How do you justify your view?
Well, as you mentioned in your very generous introduction to my career, I have lived and worked in many countries around the world. And I've done business on the front line of change in countries such as Hungary, the former Soviet Union, which then collapsed into becoming into its separate parts, and I worked in Russia, I worked in Vietnam, I worked in Africa, in Tanzania, and I had a chance, therefore, to compare different types of government. And there's no doubt in my mind that the regime that we see today in China, run by the Communist Party, fits the description, the definition of totalitarian, as such distinguished scholars as Robert Conquest, the great Anglo-American historian of the Soviet Union, as Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, and others, Hannah Arendt, the German emigre to the US. It is a totalitarian regime. It has the belief that it should exercise its authority in every sphere of life where that is feasible. An authoritarian regime is content to allow citizens to exercise some autonomy in various parts of their lives. It may be religion, for instance. It might be education. But in China, the Communist Party says, no, we, and Xi Jinping has spelt this out repeatedly, Communist Party leads north, south, east, west, and in the center, to quote his words. And you see in the crushing of freedom in Hong Kong, the totalitarian system at its most brutal. You see in the treatment of the Muslim Uyghurs in Hong Kong, in Xinjiang, you see genocide comparable to the Nazi genocide against the Jewish people in Europe. You see the same in Tibet. The word authoritarian gives you a rather reassuring feeling that it may be that China just wants to be a country like Singapore, for instance, where there is a very considerable degree of rule of law, which certainly doesn't exist in China, where individual citizens have freedom of movement and many other freedoms, which they do not now enjoy in China and will not so long as the regime is not changed. So it is totalitarian, not authoritarian, and it is very good at spreading a narrative about its own success to the world. They spend billions of dollars a year on propaganda, and they're very good at it. And it has captured the minds of far too many people in our free societies.
Indeed. I have to tell you, I'm tired of listening to the talking heads on our television tell us how good and strong China is, when I happen to know that their economy is a bloody mess. The fabric of their gross domestic product is a lot of gauze. They have built infrastructure that stands unused, and that's gauze. That's not useful spending.
And indeed, they have been poor ever since 2008. They have been pumping credit into the economy until they have built, without meaning to, one of the highest debt mountains the world has ever seen. No nation, economic historians tell us that no nation in the world has ever succeeded in seriously reducing a debt mountain as high as China's without either recession or inflation. And the authorities of China know that full well. Why do they do it? Why have they done it? Well, they fear the consequences, the political and social consequences of recession in China. If they don't keep people employed, they're going to have unrest on the streets. They're going to have corporate defaults. They're going to have bank defaults. So they've been pumping credit into the system, and because they have abandoned the transition to the market economy before completing it, they've got a hybrid economy in which the commanding heights are still under the control of the Communist Party. Banking, transportation, utilities, are under the control of the Communist Party, and so interest rates are not liberalized. So when you get that, you get, and you get, you combine that with a dynamic private sector on which it, the party relies to produce the jobs and the growth in the economy. When you get, when you combine these things, of course, the private sector is going to be looking to find money, lend money, any which way it can, and devising all kinds of schemes which are on the margin of legality and which are highly risky, not because they are criminally minded people, but because they are denied the safer, more transparent methods of doing finance. So yes, I agree with you, Rick. This economy has great problems, and you talked of infrastructure, unused infrastructure. Yes, ghost cities of apartment blocks left empty. Yes, bridges to nowhere, airports without flights into them. Why? It all comes back to their political need to keep pumping credit into the economy, and the result has been a great decline in productivity. Since 2008, the return on every dollar invested in the economy has diminished from 4 to 1. That is a spectacular drop in productivity.
Amazing. One of the topics that is burning is Taiwan. That is a tinderbox waiting to explode.
Yep.
I think both the Chinese and the Americans and the whole world knows that if there's a shooting war over Taiwan, there will be no winners. And that's a concern. I think what the U.S. would do is an economic war. It is my opinion, shared by more than a few people, that we could, if we wanted, destroy China's economy at the snap of a finger. And I think that is what's keeping China, not the threat of a war, a shooting war, but that is what's keeping China from moving on Taiwan. Your coup d'etat that you talk about in the book is sparked off by a confrontation between the U.S. and China, which enables Xi's rivals to move against him. On what do you base this?
Delighted to speak to that. Let me first say that I agree with you that the U.S. and its allies have great economic superiority over China, which they have not applied until now, but which, if it came to war, they could apply. We could apply it to devastating effect, which is not to discount the military defense of Taiwan, which I think would also be devastating. I mean, I don't think it would be a walkover for the mainland PLA. But going back to the to the confrontation, absolutely right. You've read the book with close attention. My book opens page 1. With the Prime Minister of China, Li Keqiang, sitting at his desk in his office in the Zhongnanhai, and seeing come up on his screen a news flash which says that the U.S. regulatory authorities have suspended from listing and trading on Chinese, on U.S. exchanges 5 leading Chinese companies listed and traded in the U.S. And it has done so because those companies have been unable to provide the U.S. regulatory authorities with the financial information which the authorities require of companies listed in the U.S. from any nation. Why? Because the Communist Party has forbidden them from doing so. Now, this is not fact. This is not part of the fiction. This is fact. And the fact is that all 270-odd Chinese companies listed and traded on U.S. exchanges are in breach of their obligations to provide full financial disclosure. And Congress, in the last weeks of the Trump administration, passed unanimously a law, then immediately signed into law by President Trump, which will force the U.S. regulatory authorities to do just that, to support, to suspend and from trading and listing any companies from any country which do not conform to those financial disclosure regulations within 3 years. And now Congress is moving to shorten that period of 3 years to maybe 2 years.
Okay.
That is a confrontation which is not perhaps going to happen. It is going to happen unless the Communist Party of China and Xi Jinping backs off and yields on this extremely important point, on which it has refused to yield for years.
Okay.
So there is a grave likelihood of a confrontation. When that happens, Premier Li Keqiang and his close allies in the leadership can see that what begins as a confrontation between financial markets could very well lead on to other forms of economic warfare with the U.S. administration if it does not gain satisfaction from the Chinese government. The U.S. administration could move on to imposing sanctions on Chinese banks, shutting them out of the world trading system.
Roger, I'm sorry to say we are running out of time. I would love to continue this. This is an incredibly great interview. I can assure you that when next I am in England, I will give you a call and take you out to dinner.
That would be a pleasure, Rick. It would be good to meet you.
All right. Well, you have been listening to the Conservative Thought Hour.
Thank you for listening to the Conservative Thought Hour. Remember what Albert Einstein said. The world is a very dangerous place, not because of the evil men in it, but because of the good men who do nothing.